Would you tell us if you have opposition from anybody that you dispose of them by having them stuffed in the trunk? Is that what you do, Mr. Giancana?
It's plain to answer because I always believe my answer might come in
from you. Tell us anything about any of your operations, or you just giggle every time I ask you a question?
It's plain to answer because I always believe my answer might come in from you.
I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana.
Well, this is Bulldog Drummond, better known as John Drummond, and we're listening, of course, to Gangland Wire today, and thanks for the good intro. It makes, I might sign you up as an agent when you talk that big to me. All right.
So when they take the silver dollar, they
got to
go around to different banks.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there back here in the Ice House, classic old Ice House in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Folks, we are back with part two of the story, Life and Times of Sam Giancana, with our good friend from Chicago, Mike Byrne. How you doing tonight, Mike?
I'm doing good, Gary. How you doing? How you doing, Aaron?
Good.
Well, Mike, before we get started back on Giancana, we talked a little bit about your Facebook page. Remind me the name of that Facebook page you've got.
It's called the Chicago Outfit Old and Current News and Articles.
Great, and I follow it all the time. It's a great history of the Chicago Outfit from about, 1960 to really up to current times. There's not many articles in the current newspapers, but, there was a pile of them back in the 60s and 70s, that's for sure. And kind of an interesting story about that. I noticed Mike put one up, and it was an article during the skimming from Las Vegas trials, and there was a bunch of wiretaps that had been audio from hidden microphones that had been entered as evidence. And when they did, the newspapers, the Tribune, they'd sent reporters down here to Kansas City. Those trials were being held in Kansas City, and they would cover the trials, and they would write about the trial each day. Well, on this one particular day, there was a hidden microphone was going in Alan Dorfman's office, who was a Teamster confederate of the outfit and helped them get loans to give to casino owners so they can get the kickback, the skim. And Alan Dorfman and a guy named Saul Schwartz, who I can't remember what his connection was. He was some other...
I think he was a business associate of Dorfman's.
That's what I thought.
He worked in the office. I mean, he was just, I think, a lower level guy, but he worked in the Teamster Pension Fund office, I believe.
That's kind of what I thought, because I've got several other pieces of audio with him in it. On this particular day, and what the article was about Dorfman talking with Schwartz about who was going to be the new boss of the outfit in Chicago. Iupa had a really bad heart problems at this point in time. He was going to trial, and it looked like he may be going away, and in fact, he did go away. He effectively had to hand over the reins either during this trial or after the trial, never talking about who would be the next boss. What all did they have to say? Do you remember, Mike?
I remember Dorfman was telling Schwartzman about saying how all the young guys were meeting on a regular basis. They were using his office because they felt safe there, which ironically, the place was full of bugs. They were meeting there, and he was telling them, saying, like, well, there's two contenders. He would refer to them as by their nick. He would say, like, there's the guy in the south side, and that was Al Pilato, who was the Chicago Heights boss. And then he said, and then there's Jackie, who was Jackie Cerrone, obviously. And he said, Jackie is the right man for the job, but he's a little too hot-headed. And he said, and with Pilato, he said he's unsure if Pilato is experienced enough for the job. And so, but you see, he thought those were the two top contenders because he said Iupo recently suffered a heart attack, and so the upper management was very concerned about, and plus, like I said, the trials were coming up soon. It was just Dorfman telling him. It almost sounded like he was almost bragging in a way about how the younger guys were all coming to use his office to meet.
And this is the audio that Gary went through, and he found some of the actual audio where they talk about this.
Yeah, Gary found, I posted the article one day, and Gary sent me a message saying, he's like, I think I actually might have this audio. And I remember I responded saying, oh, my God, I would love to hear this. I mean, it would be amazing to find this because, I mean, I don't think it's ever been really publicly shared before. I know they used it in trial, and Gary actually then found it a few hours later and was able to post it with the article. And so, it was very helpful to my group and everything, and I was very grateful for Gary for doing that because people, I mean, you really get to see a firsthand look about hearing these guys. You can put voices to the faces. I mean, people see the photos of these guys, but they actually hear them speaking and talking so openly about mob business. I mean, Dorfman was killed, I believe, 2 years later, but I'm sure when those tapes are played at the trial, I'm sure Iupa and those guys, if they could kill Dorfman again, they would have gladly killed him again.
Yeah, he didn't need to be talking like that. Another interesting thing they said in that conversation was they were talking about if the guy from the South Side didn't get it, there was going to be hell to pay. He was going to be shooting him up or something. I don't remember exactly what he said.
Oh, that's right. But... yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, in a way, he was kind of talking, not really talking bad about him, but yeah, kind of talking behind their backs, really? Calling Jackie Cerrone hot-headed, and which rumor was he was a hot-headed guy, but still, to say it on audio, I'm sure Cerrone didn't appreciate hearing that in court.
Certainly. And those Spilotro fans out there, there's always arguments about Tony Spilotro's influence and what his position was, and with back in Chicago because he'd been out in Vegas so long, and he'd had, he and Dorfman were really close because of that Vegas connection, because of the casino loans, and Dorfman made some mention about the guy out west coming back, and he said, I told him, I said, you need to come on back. If you'd come on back before, you'd be the heir apparent right now. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's right.
You never got it.
Yeah, Spilotro and Dorfman, they had a long history. They were indicted in a the Teamster Pension Fund case in the 70s with Daniel Seifert, when they were using Daniel Seifert's business to launder mob money and stuff, and Dorfman and Spilotro were both indicted together on that case, and that's when the mob murdered Daniel Seifert in front of his wife and son. The bosses were very upset about that one. Iupa and Accardo, they actually called Spilotro in, and according to FBI documents, his punishment was they took Spilotro off the outfit payroll as his punishment for doing a sloppy job on the murder. They did, apparently Accardo and Iupa, which obviously, I mean, everyone would agree, killing someone in front of the wife and child is probably not the best way to approach a murder, but guys like Lombardo and Spilotro, that's the way those guys worked. I mean, they didn't really think about the consequences. They just acted, and apparently Accardo and Iupa were very upset with both them.
Well, I wonder if there's any Spilotro Dorfman interview or recordings in Gary's archive. Cause
there are.
Yeah, I'm curious.
I'm sure they...
See, he's holding out. This whole time, I knew it. We talk about this, and he's always like, oh, well, the audio on that's just not very good, And I'm like, but it's actually them. It's them. Like I wonder, if you listen to the recordings, if at any point Alan Dorfman goes, we cannot have a Chicago mob boss whose nickname is Lackey.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine. I always thought that was kind of ironic that. I think that was more of the term the press would use to him, mm-hmm. but I always thought it was kind of a weird nickname for a guy, especially a guy like who was so high up in the organization, the Lackey. It doesn't sound like it's a very powerful name.
No.
He actually was a very powerful guy, but it was kind of a weird nickname.
Well, what I read was, and maybe John Drummond may have verified this, that the press started calling him Jackie the Lackey because every time you saw him, he was driving Accardo around.
That's right. Yeah, he was always with Accardo. He was driving him. He was always spotted eating with them, so yeah, that's how he earned his nickname.
So one thing when I'm researching on Sam Giancana a little more, that he was at the Apalachin meeting in 1957. So he must have been like an heir apparent then. I think
that must have been one of his first probably that was probably one of his first big, probably big showings as the new boss of Chicago, probably, because I think it's usually given that his time as boss was right around 1957, and that's when the Appalachian meeting took place. So he was probably, I mean, that was probably one of the first meetings probably where he represented Chicago as, you know, as the new boss of the outfit. Carlo at that point was stepping back, and he and Connor to represent Chicago at that meeting.
Well, we're getting on up into the early 60s. He's the boss. And that's when...
Correct, yeah. By the 60s, yeah, Giancana was definitely running the show by the 60s.
Right, and he is a high-profile guy. He is out in Las Vegas. He's is he dating Dorothy McGuire, the McGuire sisters, by that point in time?
Yeah,
he's in the newspapers.
Yep. Yeah, Phil. Yeah, he was always spotted with Phyllis McGuire flying to and from Chicago. I mean... They were spotted together. I mean, it was almost like how TMZ spots like Hollywood celebrities out there. I mean, the Tribune and Sun Times were snapping photos of them coming out of the fanciest restaurants. I mean, it almost seems like he hardly had any time to get to Chicago to run the outfit. And I think there was actually a few wiretaps eventually picked up where that was the concern of Picardo eventually. But Giancana was not spending a lot of time back in Chicago handling things the way he should. But you know, but as a boss, though, I mean, I guess when you're the boss, you kind of do things your own way. With the show The Untouchables, Desi Arnaz production show,
yeah,
when that was on TV, apparently Sam Giancana sent a person out. Apparently, at one point, Giancana was so upset about it, show, because it focused more on the Prohibition mob, but apparently, at one point, Sam Giancana was so upset that. Rumor was he wanted to pit a hit out on Desi Arnaz, which
oh, wow.
It was probably just a rumor, but I mean, no, there was never any confirmation to that. But apparently, Desi Arnaz, word got to him about that, though, that Chicago mobsters were upset about the show. And I don't know if there was a met like saying, hey, could you like not use current guys' names, whatever? And they never did. They always kind of stopped like Frank Nitti. That era, The Untouchables, but there was a big story about that, about how Sam Giancana was upset about that and tried to put an end to the show or tried to like make threats. I don't think take legal action, but they were very upset that it was bringing undue attention to the outfit.
Sam is in Las Vegas. He's making all these different connections. He makes connections with Robert Mayhew, who is Howard Hughes' main guy, or former FBI agent, is now Howard Hughes' main guy. Somehow. He gets approached to assassinate Fidel Castro, and which is kind of a natural
right.
for the CIA to think, well, we need some help with Castro. Let's go to the mob, because they know that when Castro took over the government down there in Cuba, he nationalized all the casinos and basically closed them all down and kicked all the mobsters out. And they could
yep,
they could
exactly,
bribe
yeah.
the government before, but they couldn't bribe the communist government.
It was
leave or die.
Castro threw them out immediately. Yeah, and I think, I mean, that, and that was a smart move in a way on the CIA's part, because they knew, why get their hands dirty when they can get someone like Sam Giancana to, you know, to do it for them. And there's always been stories about how close they came, and the most recent thing I heard was, and like I said, this is all not fledged information, but apparently the story goes that they were supposed to send two mobsters. One of them was Willie Messino, and the other one was supposed to be Sam DiStefano. Apparently, Sam DiStefano had a prison sentence coming up, and the CIA's agreement was if they accomplished the mission and killed Castro, they would make Sam DiStefano's prison sentence go away. And apparently, rumor has it that both men made it ashore, but then something happened where something scared them off, or something happened where they couldn't get closer. But like I said, this is all hearsay, so I mean, who really knows if those two men were involved and stuff, but that's the rumor, though, and apparently they wanted to do it by a cyanide capsule they wanted to use. They wanted to pit it in a drink, or at least get someone close enough to Castro that could pit the cyanide capsule in a drink, and that's what they were going to poison them. That's the original plan they were going to go by, but, you know, it's a fascinating story. I mean, I would love to be able to sit and read the files on all that stuff, but the stuff, you know, with the CIA and Giancana. I mean, I know some of it's kind of been released, but it's redacted, and, you know, it's hard to know what really happened. But it's been pretty much, I mean, Johnny Roselli was also on top with that. He was kind of the middleman with Giancana, with Bob Mayhew and the CIA. Yeah, that. And that's what I think ultimately led up to eventually, I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead, but which ultimately led to Johnny Roselli's murder in 75, too.
Yeah, I think there's enough out there that enough in different testimonies that it probably did happen. He was approached. I think he probably did create a plan.
I believe 100%. Yeah, I definitely believe Giancana definitely was approached by CIA. It's almost pretty much been confirmed, but like there was definitely contact. I mean, that's pretty much been established. But the real missing piece of the puzzle is how far that murder plot got until it was abandoned. And who abandoned it? Was it Giancana's men or is it the CIA back out? No, that's the one piece of the puzzle that is really the question that I would really love to really get an answer to, because it's a fascinating, really fact. They could make a movie just on that alone, the plot to assassinate, Castro, because there's so much written about that and names have been thrown around about who's been involved. And I know a guy, a low-level hoodlum by the name of Charles Camaldi, who worked for Sam DiStefano. He ended up flipping, and he was one of the guys who gave testimony later in the 70s when they were doing the hearings on the JFK assassination and all that stuff. And he gave information, but I think he was proven unreliable because he just kind of told a lot of stuff that was proven false later on. So a lot of his testimony just kind of went by the wayside. But definitely, Giancana definitely did meet with the CIA at some point. They definitely definitely met.
Well, there's some documents that you can find that link in through the Wikipedia called Family Jewels.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of just Google Family Jewels and Castro assassination, and you can go read a lot of those, as Mike said, those heavily redacted documents of testimony and FBI reports and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, and also I think a lot of that ties also into the Bay of Pigs invasion in 61, because there's also rumors that the CIA used outfit guys to train some of the Cuban exiles who came to Florida, and they trained them to go in, like Isaac Richard Kane and Chucky Nicoletti and Phil Aldericio, who were Giancana's guys. Apparently, they allegedly trained a lot of these guys for the Bay of Pigs, which was the failed invasion of to get Cuba back. So, I mean, I think a lot of the CIA Bay of Pigs stuff all ties in with Sam Giancana.
Which kind of, we kind of have to pivot right into the whole plot on JFK, which that also came up. Did Giancana or the Chicago outfit have anything to do with that? There's been a lot of speculation on that.
That's probably the biggest question people ask. The people who have a very casual, or people who I meet who they know my interest in the outfit, and they only ask about the JFK assassination, and did the outfit have a hand in that? And I always answer them, I go, you know what, there's so many rumors. I mean, in Chuck Giancana's book, Chuck Giancana claims that Sam kind of was very vague when Chuck would bring the subject up to him about the Kennedy assassination. And I know there were FBI wiretaps at the time that overheard Sam talking about the assassination, but nothing incriminating about it, though. He would always kind of never said anything to incriminate himself, but I don't think he had as big a part of it. I think he's a powerful man. I think he definitely probably had a hand in maybe getting maybe the person who was the gunman for it, but like, it's so hard to say, though. I mean, there's so many, that's one of those subjects that'll always be debated probably till, 100 years from now, that JFK assassination is going to be debated and debated. Who was involved and who pulled the trigger. I mean, I've spoken to Red Womet's actually a really good person to talk to about this, because he's spoken to people. He was friends with Marshal Caifano, and Marshal Caifano was rumored to be one of the men in Dallas that day. But like I said, that's a very interesting part, though, about Giancana's run as boss, because that's right around the time, like I said, that then, you go into the whole Vegas Rat Pack era, Giancana's name. When I go back to the Chicago Tribune archives, you type in Sam Giancana, the amount of articles that come up from 1961 to about 1966 probably number into the eight or 900 articles, probably.
Wow.
I wonder, Sam Giancana, just that time period. I mean, he was being written about on a daily basis in the Chicago papers. I mean, he was probably written about more than the Mirror Daily was at the time.
That I was going to say was, I mean, I'm looking back on, you look on YouTube and there's a lot of different video stuff. I watched a particular video that wanted to tie Jack Ruby to the Chicago mob and Lee Harvey Oswald's father to the New Orleans mob and Traficante.
Carlos Marcello.
Oh, yeah.
And that's that's the rumor, is Carlos Marcello and the Chicago outfit somehow collaborated on, setting up Oswald to take the fall and then Jack Ruby to kill him. And tied it up in a nice, neat little bowl.
Jack Ruby was definitely tied to Chicago. I mean, he was from Chicago. He was close associates with Lenny Patrick, who was a top Jewish mobster. So, to me, that links Giancana. That does link Giancana to the JFK assassination, because why would they get a guy like Jack Ruby in there to kill Oswald?
I know, of all people.
That doesn't add up.
So that he doesn't talk.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't. I agree, Mike. That's the one thing I'm really skeptical about. They set up Lee Harvey Oswald as a fall guy, and then he turns around and he kills a Dallas policeman and... getaway.
Jack Ruby,
that's what that boy, when that came into light and all his background, I was like, you know, that kind of a strip club owner doesn't go down and do a political killing. They just don't do it.
Exactly.
I mean, I've known a few strip club owners in my life, and they don't go do that.
Yeah, exactly. If Jack Ruby never shot Oswald, and that never happened, I would say, you know what, Giancana probably didn't have anything to do with it. But once Jack Ruby was involved and his name was in there, a strip club owner from Texas who has major ties to the outfit, who was associated with many outfit members back home, I mean, yeah, to go and shoot a guy who was just accused of killing the president of the United States, that doesn't happen on a everyday basis. He just walked right in there, walked right up to him and shot him like that. Jack Ruby Giancana definitely had, there was definitely a meeting very shortly after Oswald's arrest, and a decision was made that they had to kill him immediately. I mean, that happened very quick, so... There was obviously a lot of concerned people out there, probably mobsters and CIA people, who knew that they had to silence Oswald.
Maybe Jack Ruby just meant to give him a lap dance, and he got the misunderstanding.
He
slipped him on the bill one night. Really? He didn't pay his tab.
But, you know, that and that kind of brings us to why would he care so much about JFK? And if you remember, after JFK became president, he appointed his brother, the attorney general, and he had Daley in Chicago had really helped put Kennedy over in that election of 1960.
So, oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, they said that Chicago is one of the big factors of getting Kennedy that election. And the rumor to that was it was supposedly Joe Kennedy, Robert and Jack's father, came and met Sam Giancana and allegedly made a statement saying, hey, if you can do this for my son, this will guarantee a spot in the White House for you. Basically saying that, like, we'll let you do your own thing and not bother you. And Sam Giancana was under the impression that, okay, we do this for the Kennedys, we can pretty much do things our own way and be left alone. And one of the first things Robert Kennedy does is he comes in and goes right after Sam Giancana, like one of his first targets. So, I mean... That right there. I mean, who knows what really happened? But there was definitely some pull from Chicago, though. Frank Culotta even wrote in his book one time. He even said in an interview that he was just a burglar at the time when Kennedy was elected. But he even said he heard on the streets from outfit guys saying, "Hey, listen, do what you got to do, but make sure you get you and your friends to go out there and vote for Kennedy. We got to get this guy in office and stuff." So I mean, the outfit was definitely doing some, work for the Kennedy, getting the vote out there. Back then in Chicago, it wasn't rare to find, dead people voting. You would have voters people who died in World War II, and they'd still be casting votes in the 1960s and 70s. Chicago's always had a history of the mystery voters popping up and for in the mayoral race and everything. So there was that the JFK Giancana connection. There's always been a real strong connection. And the, like I said, that ties into Marilyn Monroe. By the 1960s, Sam Giancana's life, it really did play out in the press. Just the way everything he was involved with.
Yeah, and for more reasons than one, he as part of the new organized crime strike force in Chicago and the new Top Hoodlum program with the FBI, our friend Bill Romer comes on the scene, and he's part of. They create what they call Operation Lockstep.
You know
what that was? That was they followed Sam Giancana everywhere he went. They were about a foot off of his bumper.
Yep, they even said if Sam Giancana took a piss in the restaurant, the FBI were in the next stall right next to him taking a piss.
And if he was on the golf course, they were the foursome right behind him, driving up into him all the time and laughing. And they'd stand up by watching putt and stand up there and laugh while he'd putt. Oh, they were brutal, I understand. That Bill Romer, I don't know if you know anything about him, but FBI agent, he was
I read all his books.
He would be the kind of guy that would walk up to the tee box, or not to the tee box, but to the green while you're putting and start laughing and making noise. That's something he would do. And actually, Sam did an unheard of thing at that point in time. Chicago, historically, the bosses are supposed to stay in the background and let other people go out and do the work. Well, here this boss is. He sues the FBI in civil court for following him around. Talk about coming out front with it, that yeah, I'm the mob guy and they're following me around and I'm suing you for it. And actually, he won. They ordered him to stay foursome back and to give him some room. I understand they took their own video. The lawyer hired a private detective that then took video when Sam would be doing family functions or going to church or doing some normal business kind of things. They would stand there and film the FBI's and show just exactly how close they were, how they were right on top of them.
I would pay so much money to get my hands on those videos. I always wonder what happens to those. I mean, they probably used those old Super 8 cameras back then.
Yeah, that video's long gone.
If I had the money, I would pay top dollar to get my hands on those, to get those transferred to DVD. You could sell those, and people would buy this just to see. Those videos gotta be so funny, especially with them on the golf course playing golf or them. But yeah, you're right though. I mean, that's when Sam Giancana was probably one of the only mobsters, especially at that time, that successfully sued the FBI and won. And apparently, though, too, that's when Cardo and Rico were really upset about it, because they did not want Sam suing the FBI, bringing attention, because at that time, the outfit, they were not supposed to exist. They're supposed to be a secret organization. These guys aren't supposed to be in the press. And here you have the boss of the outfit at front headlines of the newspaper suing FBI agents for harassment. So it was kind of really... I mean, the FBI actually was smart on the FBI's part, even though the FBI lost in the court system, but it still hurt Giancana, because Accardo and Rica were really getting fed up at that point then. Even guys close to Giancana, like Chuck English, he was apparently telling Murray Humphreys, who was a political fixer for Accardo and those guys, that Sam was starting to lose it. Sam was making really rash decisions on stuff and not thinking clearly, and really the FBI were really getting to Sam. And I think that was the FBI's whole, that's what their whole plan was. They wanted to drive Sam nuts.
Hey, Mike.
That's my dog there. Sorry about that.
Hey, Mike, now is this about the time when he goes to Mexico? Didn't he do a stint in jail for refusing to testify?
Yep.
And then when he comes out, He goes to Mexico.
Yep, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's really another thing the FBI did. They did too. Is they called Sam? The FBI fanned out all around Chicago, subpoena Giancana, Chuck English. I mean, anyone, even the lowest level guys. If you were a burglar for the outfit, you got subpoenaed. And what they did is they got a couple of low level guys and brought them in front of the grand jury. And basically, they purposely kept them in the grand jury room for hours, asking mundane questions, just so it would appear to Giancana these guys were talking, because they'd be like, Jesus, why are you guys spending 6 hours in the grand jury? They got to be saying something. and the FBI purposely did that to frighten Giancana. And so when Sam Giancana appeared, and I don't know if this is the first time it was ever used, but it was definitely one of the first times they gave Sam Giancana full immunity. So Sam Giancana could have admitted to any murder, anything he ever did wrong in his lifetime, and they would not have arrested him. I mean, talk about a deal right there. Full immunity they granted him. But by granting him full immunity, he no longer could use his Fifth Amendment right. He had two choices: tell the truth and be killed by his own men, or keep your mouth shut and be held in contempt. And Sam Giancana decided he could still try to use his Fifth Amendment right, which he ended up 18 months in the Cook County Jail, because 18 months was the length of the grand jury for that. And towards the end of the 18 months, apparently Sam wasn't holding up too well in jail. There was rumors that he offered either $1 million or $100,000 to anyone who could get him out of jail, basically. Any lawyer or anyone who could find a loophole to get him out. And there was rumors that I think his name was Ed Hanrahan. He was the guy running the investigation. He was going to call Giancana. He was going to do another grand jury and call Giancana again and do the same thing, grant him full immunity from prosecution. Once Giancana got word about that, rumor has it that once he was released after 18 months, he immediately was called to meet with Accardo. So that's the area where there's some say Accardo and Rica told him to leave town, and others say that Giancana kind of just fled on his own, basically saying, like, you know what, I got to get out of here. It's getting way too hot for him in Chicago. And that's when he went to Mexico and took up residence in Mexico.
And that's when Joey Iupa took over
They actually had a couple guys. There was, after Giancana left, Sam Battaglia took over briefly. But he only lasted about a year, and they got him on, I believe, an extortion charge. And then Bill Alderisio was boss for a short period. And then actually Jackie Cerrone actually took over for another short period, but he got indicted on a interstate gambling charge. And then that's when Iupa basically was given the reins. And once Iupa got control, he was finally the first guy really to take control and actually have good control of the outfit. And Accardo and Iupa worked really well together. Accardo is still advising on it. I think even though Sam was in exile at the time in Mexico, but Iupa took control, I think, right around 1970, I think. 71 is when Iupa took control of the outfit.
Okay. I didn't really realize about those two in between, but Iupa overshadows everybody else.
Yeah, there were such short stints that a lot of times most timelines barely even talk about it, because literally they were Battaglia, Alderisio, and Cerrone were bosses, like, literally probably for a year. I mean, that's how short of a stint it was. It was barely enough time to even, like, exert any real power.
Yeah.
But basically, Giancana and Iupa was really the next main boss after Giancana.
So what did he do in Mexico? I'm sure he had some money saved up, but a guy like that has to continue doing the rackets.
Oh, yeah. Michael Caine, who was Richard Caine's brother. Richard Caine was a Chicago cop where he worked both sides. He was a mobster and a cop, and he was one of Giancana's top guys. At that time, he was Giancana's mouthpiece in Chicago, basically. Caine was basically, he would fly down to Mexico, and at the time when Giancana was in Mexico, he started putting together gambling cruise ships. He started doing overseas casinos. He would start to put together, and that's one of the things that was rumored to be a big sore point between him and Accardo towards the end was Giancana was allegedly bringing in billions and billions of dollars in these overseas gambling operations, and Accardo felt that he owed the outfit a piece of those operations, and Giancana felt otherwise, saying, "Well, hey, I'm not part of the outfit anymore. You guys booted me out. You guys told me to leave town. This is my operation." But Accardo said, "Well, hey, you're using your name, and your name is tied to the outfit." So the rumor was that there was a real big, and Caine was kind of like the go-to gopher at the time. And according to Michael Caine, Richard Caine's brother, Richard Caine basically met Accardo one day, and Accardo basically said to Caine, "You think your man is better than us? And Richard Cain basically said, like, hey, listen, I'm just the middleman here. And the Colorado police told Cain, listen, you tell Sam, you got to fix this. You got to convince Sam that we need a piece of this. And Cain was indicted. He was indicted on multiple charges, and he ended up in prison for like 4 years. So at that time, Giancana, that era, at that point, according to like a lot of authors, he was golfing a lot in Mexico and living off whatever money he still had left over from Chicago. But apparently, the cruise ships and the overseas gamblings were a big source of money income for him while he was in Mexico.
Interesting. I've read that he lived in Cuernavaca when he was down there, which is kind of a it's what we call one of the silver cities, just south and west a little bit of Mexico City. It's pretty high up in the mountains. It's
correct.
It's always about 75 or 80 degrees during the day and about 68 degrees at night. I was there. I spent a week there, 2 weeks there once. It is the land of eternal spring. It would be a wonderful place to live.
Wow, it sounds like it. It sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it was. Now, he was down there for a while, but if I remember right, he all of a sudden Mexican police showed up and he took him to the border and dumped him across the border. Is that, you know anything about how that happened to happen?
Yeah, it happened in 1974. He was extradited back to, he landed in Texas, across the border in Texas. And when he arrived in Texas, literally, he had literally just the clothes on his back. And I remember Bill Romer actually wrote, when Giancana arrived at O'Hare Airport, when he finally did arrive, Giancana came off the plane holding his pants up by his hand because he didn't have a belt even.
But Romer loved that.
And at the time, I know. And Romer even said, and Romer said he actually felt bad for Sam. He goes, the first time in his life, he goes, actually, I felt bad for the man. And just as Sam stepped off the plane, he was handed a subpoena by another agent to appear before a grand jury investigating outfit activity. And Giancana actually looked at Romer and asked Romer, he goes, what should I do? Mm-hmm. And Romer told him, he's like, well, you should probably go in and talk to them about this. And at that point, Romer even said Giancana kind of gave him like a kind of a half-assed apology, basically. See, according to what Romer said, Giancana told him, listen, I know you and I, we've had bad blood between us, but if you're looking for an apology, this is it. I'm not good. I'm back now, but I'm not involved in anything. He goes, so if this is what you consider an apology, this is an apology. And Romer even said that he was surprised that Sam actually said that. Romer basically just kind of like, he was kind of shocked and didn't know what to say even, but he said Giancana didn't look good. You know, he was ill at that time. I know he had gallbladder surgery around that time, so he had some health issues. And I think Sam at that point now, he just wanted to find a nice, peaceful place to go and live out the rest of his days. But yeah, that was pretty much the end of his lifetime now was definitely coming up now, because he did not want to be back in Chicago at all.
Plus that grand jury subpoena now, was that the one that was going to be, he was supposed to, not a grand jury, but a subpoena before a Senate committee, the church committee on the plot to assassinate President Kennedy and investigating the CIA talked about earlier.
Yep.
So he's subpoenaed to talk to this church committee under oath shortly after he gets back. What I've read is the outfit, the hierarchy, Cardo, Iupa, I think Rica was dead by then, Jackie Cerrone. I think they were really, really unhappy with that high-profile. You know, here's one of our guys, a lifetime career outfit guy, been a boss, being subpoenaed to talk about the killing of a president. That would be
upsetting. I mean, I think Ricardo Iupa realized Sam knew, well, he knew enough about everybody in the outfit to put everybody away for the rest of their lives, which was with what Sam knew. And I think that just made Iupa and Ricardo, I mean, I don't think it probably wasn't a long discussion. I mean, they probably realized that they needed to silence Giancana. But even if Sam wasn't going to talk, it was a risk that those guys weren't willing to, they weren't willing to take that risk.
The FBI had already approached him about talking repeatedly, and he wasn't going to talk.
Oh, correct, yeah. He was approached many times, yeah. And I think at that point, too, Sam was not, he was ill. His health was failing. I mean, I don't care how much of a criminal you are or how much of a hard guy you are, like Sam Giancana was. You're that age, and you're probably the end of your life is not too far away. even the hardest guy might go soft towards the end and might be willing to talk maybe a little bit. So you just die in jail. And I think that was a card on Iupa just didn't want to risk it. I mean, I think it was more of an insurance killing than anything. They just wanted it. They had to make sure Sam was not going to, I mean, Sam knew too many secrets. He knew too many bones in those closets. And I don't think Iupa and Giancana ever really got along too well. So I think it wasn't a hard decision for Joey Iupa to make to get rid of Giancana.
He was probably happy to help take care of that one.
Oh, I'm sure he was. I'm sure Giancana was probably, I mean, I'm sure Iupa was more than happy to get approval from Accardo. Because I'm sure something like that, Accardo definitely would have to give the okay on that hit. Even though Iupa was the boss, a hit that size, that big of a hit, that's going to make major headlines. And of course, it did. When it did happen, it made major headlines.
Sam Giancana, he has returned from Mexico in July of 1974. Now, this is almost a year later, June of 1975. He's subpoenaed for church committee hearing. They've already obviously met and made the decision in the night of June 19th, 1975. Let's go into that night. That was a night there, purportedly, there was a police stakeout police guarding his property. I'm not sure. I get these different things.
Yes.
You know, the FBI had the lockstep on him for a while. Did the Chicago police, where they found him? I mean, what's the real story here? Is there any documents on this?
According to documents and according to different people who were there or new people there, the Oak Park police were there. He lived in Oak Park, Illinois at the time. Oak Park police were just watching his house. At that time, Tony Squatcho was living in Vegas, but Squatcho still owned a home in Oak Park, which Michael Squatcho's brother was living in. Tony Accardo was living in River Forest. So all the houses were very close together at that time. It wasn't rare for Oak Park police to stake out the houses on a regular basis just to keep an eye on these guys. And so you had the Oak Park police who were staking out the house that night. The FBI had people at the house that night too, because the hearings were coming up in a few days, I believe. So the feds, I think, just wanted to keep track of Sam so he wouldn't flee or anything. He had a party that night just with his daughters and a few friends, Chucky English, which was an outfit member, Dominic Butch Blassie, who was Giancana's driver for many years and probably one of his closest confidants at the time, you know, during his reign as boss. They were at the party, and his daughters, and around 10 o'clock that night, that's when the party broke up. You know, people left, and Sam's daughters left, Butch Blassie left, Chucky English left. Right around that time, a call came over, apparently, from the Oak Park police, pull off all surveillance of Sam Giancana's house at that time. But, you know, maybe that wasn't an odd thing, because obviously you're not going to sit there and do 24 hours. The local cops aren't going to do 24-hour surveillance, especially if the feds are there. For some reason, though, the feds got pulled off also. The FBI agents left the area. Maybe, I mean, some people assume maybe since it was so late, they thought, you know, well, Sam might be going to bed maybe, so maybe that's why they pulled it off. Sam's daughter, one of his daughters, later testified that she came back 10 minutes later after she left, because she left her purse in the basement where Sam was living. And she came in, saw Sam, and said, you know, oh, I left my purse here. She grabbed her purse and left. As she was leaving, Dominic Butch Blassie's car was pulling back into the front of Sam's house. And what she thought was kind of strange, because, you know, Butch was there not even a half hour ago and left. But she said it wasn't rare for that to happen, though, because they were such close friends, Dominic Blassie and Sam Giancana. Around 11 o'clock, I believe, that night, Sam had a couple who, his house, basically, they lived in Sam's house. Basically, they upkept his house, housekeepers. He called down to Sam to say that Sam needed anything, and Sam said no, he was fine. And they were watching The Tonight Show, they said. They testified to Johnny Carson. They were watching around midnight. He said he called back down to see if Sam was okay and didn't hear a response. When he came downstairs, he found Sam laying on the floor, dead with, you know, he obviously was shot several times and stuff at that point. Then he called the Oak Park police, and, you know, so that's when the investigation started. But to me, the giveaway to me was when Dominic Butch Blassie came back to the house. I still firmly believe 100% that Dominic Butch Blassie was the man who pulled the trigger on Sam Giancana.
He would be a guy who could get in there and would be welcomed in. Yep. Sam would turn his back on him. He would not be too suspicious of somebody that close if he had been the driver.
Correct. I think even one of Giancana's daughters even testified that at one point years before, Sam told his daughter that there's very few people he trusted with his life, but Butch Blassie was one of the few guys he trusted. His daughters even said, Sam would only let a few people in his house. He was that cautious. Chuck English was one of them, and Butch Blassie was another one. Years later, probably shortly after Chuck English was exiled from the outfit, as similar as Giancana was, English ends up retiring to Florida for a couple of years. And rumor has it was Chuck English was approached by Accardo's people and Iupa's people. He was allegedly approached and set up Sam for the murder. And Chuck English refused, and his punishment was he was booted out of Chicago because obviously the outfit always comes first for anything. And even if you have to kill your best friend, that's an order. You have to do that order. And apparently that's rumored to be why Chuck English was kicked out, and later eventually he was murdered himself. But I think that was unrelated to the Giancana murder. But Butch Blassie, though, he was also a driver for IUPA for a period. So Butch Blassie, he knew that Butch was smart enough to know that if he got the order from Accardo to kill Sam, that whether Blassie loved Sam or didn't love Sam, he knew he had a job to do, and he had to pull the trigger that night. There's a rumor that it was Tony Spilotro.
I've heard that rumor because he lives so close. They said he just walked over and walked home.
Yeah, that one I don't believe. You got to remember, a year before, Spilotro was used on the Daniel Seifert murder, and he pulled such a sloppy job that Accardo was so upset with him that he apparently banished him from the payroll. So a job like Sam Giancana's, that's a job they were going to get. They weren't going to risk anyone screwing this job up or doing a half-ass job.
Plus,
like Spilotro did with the Daniel Seifert murder.
Right. Would Sam Giancana let Tony Spilotro in the house and let him
advantage him? I don't think they were that close. I don't think there was that. Some people, I know Michael Corbett, who was a corrupt suburban police officer who wrote a book, and his theory is the Tony Spilotro theory.
Yeah.
He believes Spilotro did it. I've yet to come across, I've read FBI documents and stuff, and I've yet to come across anything really tying Giancana or Spilotro close together at any point in working together in anything, because Spilotro, by the time Spilotro really was coming up in the outfit and made his bones, Giancana was already exiled at that point, pretty much. So Giancana, I do know, though, although a funny side story is Tony Spilotro's widow, or his wife, Nancy Spilotro, once had an affair with Sam Giancana before Tony and her were married. And that's actually, she admitted to that, actually, in an interview with a Las Vegas magazine. She admitted to that in an interview, that she did sleep with Sam Giancana, but this is before her and Tony were ever dating or married or anything. So I thought that was kind of a funny little side note. But it's a debate that goes on even in my Facebook group. People still
notice that.
Who was the trigger man? And you do have people who think Spilotro did it. I mean, to me, just too much evidence links Butch Blassie to it. And even Bill Romer in his first book, A Man Against the Mob, he strongly indicates that Butch Blassie was the trigger man, even in the book. And Bill Romer, I know a lot of people aren't his biggest fan or anything because I know he wrote a couple of books that kind of took liberties with, but still, his book, The Man Against the Mob, is a great, great book. I always recommend that book to anyone looking to get a start on reading about the outfit from the Giancana years. I always tell them to get Bill Romer's first book because he did a great job on really breaking down on who was who in the outfit at that time period. And he spends, anyone who's interested in learning about Sam Giancana, that book focuses a lot on the lockstep that the feds did with Giancana and everything. But Bill Romer even indicates that he believes that it was definitely Butch Blassie. And later on, they actually found the gun used in the murder. It was actually, I think, maybe a mile or a quarter mile away from Butch Blassie's house. They found the gun.
Really?
So,
And it was a 22 silenced 22, just like several of those other Chicago hits.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, definitely. And also, an interesting fact, too, is during the Family Secrets trial, which took place about 11 years ago in Chicago, during the trial it came out that that it was Ronnie Jarrett and Frank Calabrese Sr. who got the murder weapon in this Giancana hit. They provided the weapon, which I found fascinating because, you know, at that time, both those guys, they were not really high-level outfit guys. According to FBI documents, that the gun was later linked to come from the Chinatown crew, like Angelo LaPietra and those guys.
Yeah.
So, just, I mean, definitely the hit had a lot. There was a lot of people somewhat involved in it, but Butch Blassie was definitely, I think, he was the last person seen on the property that night, basically, when Sam Giancana's daughter left the house.
I was going to say, people know what happened to Tony Spilotro, certainly if they've watched the movie Casino, as to whether or not he was the guy that pulled the trigger. Whoever it was had to be a close friend because there was no forced entry.
Exactly.
And the fact that they called off the local police and the Fed seems kind of like, not to say there was a connection there, but I guess a question I would have is, what happened to Dominic Butch Blassie?
Shortly after that is, he was already kind of getting older, and he was, I think in 1979, they held grand juries investigating the Giancana murder. He was called in front of the grand jury, and they did the same thing with him they did to Sam. They granted him immunity if he would talk. He refused. He served 18 months in Cook County Jail, like Sam did. Never spoke. He got released. According to what the Fed said in documents, he spent the rest of the 1980s as kind of just more of like a, almost kind of similar to like a cardo, kind of like a, he would be seen around town kind of mingling with the younger guys. He was kind of more of like an advisor during the 80s. And then in the late 80s, because Bill Romer and him had kind of a relationship. They weren't friendly with each other. They weren't friends, but they both kind of had mutual respect for each other, because at one point, Blassie was accused of running the burglary ring right around the time of the Giancana murder. And Bill Romer actually went to the grand jury and testified on behalf of Butch Blassie. And thanks to Romer, Butch Blassie wasn't indicted for the burglary ring. Blassie always thanked Romer. Every time he saw Romer after that, he always thanked Romer for doing that for him, saying, thanks for not framing me and thanks for doing that. So Romer always kind of indicated that him and Blassie kind of had a mutual respect. And in the late 80s, when Romer wrote his book, Man Against the Mob, he tried contacting Butch Blassie, and he heard back from his wife saying that he was living in a retirement home. He had early signs of Alzheimer's disease, and he ended up dying in 93. He ended up passing away in a retirement home. And I guess by the time he died, he was completely, his mind was gone at that point. So Romer wanted to speak to him before he died and see if he would maybe give a statement before dying. But his wife told Romer that he wouldn't even recognize Romer. He was that far gone with Alzheimer's at that point. So he basically asked the Giancana murder. Blassie basically faded out of the picture in the outfit. I think he did such a big favor to the outfit. I think Ricardo and those guys, they let him kind of retire peacefully at that point.
You know, Frank Calabrese Jr. says that if you take his family secrets tour, he will reveal who the actual killer was.
Correct, yeah.
You went on that tour, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I mean, he does indicate that Butch Blassie was
okay.
The shooter, too.
All right.
Yeah,
he
indicated in there. Yeah, I mean, someone like Frank would have definitely way more access than I probably do with his, just with his knowing what his father knew probably. But yeah, he indicates on the tour that, yeah, Butch Blassie was the shooter and the murderer. But he mentions how Spilotro was accused of it, too. And people like to link Spilotro to, like, I mean, murders. I mean, there's people link him to murders probably to after he died. People still have
he was still killing
murders.
People.
And he had no part in either, because guys want to be. The thing is, people assume that outfit had like people who were just hitmen, but outfit, they would use anybody to kill. I mean, if you were an outfit guy, and that's one thing the family secrets trial proved was that. I mean, if the outfit wanted you to kill somebody, no matter who you were, but they chose you, you had to do it. You know, and if you didn't, you weren't going to last very long, or you would never become a trusted associate. So
that whole myth about, you know, the high paid hitman, he gets $20,000-$25,000 a hit. That's all bunk too, because they do it for free.
Hollywood.
They just do it.
These guys will do it just to get the favor. That's how you moved up the ladder back then. You killed somebody, that was a major step up in the organization. You were trusted, you know, if you could handle yourself like that. So, yeah, there was never any money exchange for killing somebody.
I guess, you know, one more thing, and then we're going to sign off of this. We've got two full episodes and then some, I think. Finding the body of Johnny Roselli in an oil drum down in Miami. How does that fit back into Sam Giancana? Because they were connected and they were close, and he had a lot to do with as a middleman or something with that Castro assassination.
Johnny Roselli also received a grand jury summons to the same assassination committee that Giancana was supposed to carry.
Oh, really?
For.
He was. I'll be darned! I didn't realize that.
Yeah, he was supposed to testify too, and he was living at the time in Florida with his sister at the time. I mean, I think it was days, maybe a week or two, or days before he was supposed to testify, he disappeared, and then shortly after he was found in an oil drum in Skane Bay, I believe. They found him in.
I think so.
And this is interesting. Is Red Ouimet, Red Ouimet did a story in my Facebook about this. Red Ouimet says that Frank Schweiss was the guy who killed Johnny Roselli.
Ah.
He did the job on him. But obviously, I mean, allegedly, because there's, I mean, obviously Frank Schweiss was never ever convicted of that murder or never brought, you know, there's no evidence really linking him, but I can't remember. Red told me the backstory, and if people who go to my Facebook group, I'll post that story again, because Red does a video of himself, and I'll post it on there. But he told the backstory about how he got the story out. I don't know if Frank told him, because Frank was very open. Frank Schweiss was very open with Red about some of his jobs. But, yeah, Johnny Roselli, though, it was the same situation, I think. I think the outfit just, at that point, they killed Sam. And once they knew Johnny Roselli was in the same situation. He was hurting financially, Johnny Roselli. I mean, he was so broke, he was living with his sister in Florida.
Wow.
So he was really hurting money-wise. I think the outfit just got really bad feelings, saying, well, this guy could really cut a good deal for himself. And I think they just kind of, and later on, Jimmy Fradiano, who was obviously a Chicago and Los Angeles mobster, he later testified that shortly after Johnny Roselli was murdered, Joey Ayupa kind of gave him a test and told him, he goes, hey, they found that Roselli guy, they found him in a, you know, down in Florida, an oil drum. How do you feel about that? And Jimmy Fradiano later testified that Ayupa was testing him, because if Fradiano came back saying, I think that's terrible, and I would love to find out who did this, because I want to get revenge, he says he would never would have left that room alive that day. He said Ayupa would have had him shot right there in the spot. Ayupa wanted to see what Fradiano's loyalty was at that time.
Interesting.
And once Fradiano said, hey, basically Fradiano said, well, you know what, probably did something they shouldn't have done, and that's why he ended up in that oil drum. And Ayupa kind of gave him a little nod, kind of like, yeah, I agree, kind of nod.
Yeah, you passed.
to it and stuff. But yeah, Roselli and Giancana, I think, were both killed for, I think, basically the same reasons, you know, to silence them.
Because of the Kennedy assassination?
Maybe more for the CIA stuff, but definitely the Kennedy stuff, the CIA stuff, and, you know, and I'm sure Carlo probably figured, well, the CIA is going to be pretty happy about this. You know, here's these two guys who apparently did business with them. If they disappear, I don't think the CIA is going to be too concerned about it.
It would have been really embarrassing for the CIA,
those guys to come out. Oh, God.
At that point in time.
Yeah, stories came out there that, like, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, I mean, and I'm just saying this off the top, it wouldn't surprise me if the CIA even had a hand in something.
Killing both of them, really.
Murder.
I can understand
it. They probably didn't have any, I mean, I'm sure Cardo felt that if they silenced both men, he knew the government probably wouldn't come after him too heavily, or the CIA definitely wouldn't come after him, or the CIA would use whatever connections they had to,
they would call over to the FBI. You know, the Chicago police wasn't going to do anything about either one of them anyhow on their best day. So the FBI was the only operation left to take any action on these kinds of murders. And with the CIA saying, hey, you know, let's just leave this sleeping dog live.
I think there's a lot of people high up in, you know, CIA, and even maybe in the government, there's people high up who I think it was like, yeah, like you said, just let the sleeping dogs lie. Don't let's not rock the boat here. You know, two old mobsters are dead. Let's just leave it at that. To this day, like I said, to this day, it's still a highly debated and talked about subject. Why were they killed and who was involved? And, you know, I mean, there's always rumors about, like, who was did it. But, I don't know. Butch, I mean, you look at the evidence. I mean, people who really look to sit and look at it and read the evidence, saying Butch Blassie, I mean, 99.9%, that's how sure I am about it, that he pulled the trigger. But I guess there's always that doubt. You know, since there was never any indictments, there's always going to be that little bit of doubt that, you know, who did it. But, I mean, all the evidence points to Dominic Butch Blassie.
No one saw him, so he obviously had his, he must have been surveilling the location at the time to know that everybody had left.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, too, because real quick, years ago, a local guy here whose father was a mobster, his name's Joe Fosco, he wrote an article, actually, about Sam Domenici, because he was friends with, growing up, through his dad, he knew a lot of younger mobsters, and he was told that on the night of the murder, Jackie Cerrone, John DeFranzo, and a few Elmwood Park guys, they were lookouts for the murder. They drove around the neighborhood making sure that the feds were gone and the police were not around. I mean, I don't know how much truth is to that rumor, but that's another rumor that goes around, that there was a lot of other guys in the area doing surveillance, like mobsters were doing surveillance to make sure that everyone was away from the house. And then once they knew, Butch Blassie got the signal to go in and do the job.
All right. Well, this has been great, Mike. This is most illuminating. It's everything you want to know about Sam Mooney Giancana, and then some, I would say. You are an expert. We'll have to have you back. What else are you an expert in? What about Richard Caine? Can you give us a? Now, I don't want it tonight, but I'm just curious. I've always been curious about Richard Caine. There's so much more to this guy than meets the eye.
Yeah,
you know a lot about him.
I can definitely give you a show on Richard
Caine.
Okay,
all right.
He's another
we'll
guy
do one on
a
Richard
very fascinating
Caine.
Guy we can go into. Yeah, we should definitely do something on Richard Caine next time. Because he's right. Another fascinating story.
What about Frank the German Suisse?
Oh yeah, God. I mean, Red Womet's probably the expert on him. Red Womet. Dealt with him. He was a close associate of Frank the German for, God, probably a good 10, 15 years. They met all the time. And Red still has the surveillance videos he has of all the meetings that he had with Frank Schweitzer. So,
right.
Frank Schweitzer is another individual. I mean, there's that's the thing with the Alpha. There's so many guys we could do hours on.
Now, that's one more, and then we'll let you go. I've done a lot of research. I'm thinking about just doing this myself. On Harry Aleman, but what about Harry?
Oh, yeah.
He's quite a story.
Oh, here, yeah. Here's another guy. You could easily do a good show on him.
I think we could probably do maybe three series on him. He was quite.
He was probably one of the first cases where the double jeopardy clause.
Right. That's what drew my attention to him. It was so interesting that he was the first person ever to be convicted of a crime after being found innocent of the same crime in basically the same court with a different judge and different jury. So
that's another
jillion stories up there in Chicago. We're going to keep doing Chicago stories. We got a New York month coming up. I'm going to have four New York stories.
Great.
But we got that Havana, the Cuban mob coming up. And we got one about old-time dope dealers back in the 30s coming up.
That'd be
organized crime, Italian organized crime, really are the ones that started the dope business in the United States. So we got those coming up, and then we'll get back to Chicago. And I'll certainly give you a call, and we'll coordinate on at least those two subjects for sure.
You know, another one I don't think we've ever
done,
although it's not Chicago, would be Traffic Conte.
Yeah.
We have to get that.
What's his name? Dice, Scott Dice, who wrote the book Garden State Gangland. That's about New Jersey, but he's an expert on the Tampa mob, on Santos Traficante. That would be a good one. All right, Mike, I really appreciate you being here, folks.
Thanks again for having me.
And we're going.
Thank you so much.
Right after this, we're going to play that audio that we talked about, the Dorfman audio. I'll play a little bit of that so you can hear what Alan Dorfman talks about.
Well, and folks, you need to go out and subscribe to Mike Burns' Facebook group, Chicago Outfit, Old and Current News and Articles.
It's a good one, and you'll get to hear from Red with Matt, and you'll get to see me comment and put stuff up once in a while, and Mike will put up anywhere from, what, 3 to 10 or 12 articles every day informing you about the outfit. All right, good night, Mike.
If you subscribe, I have anywhere from 3 to 12 to 15 articles a day. Thanks again for having me. Good night, guys.
All right, good night, Mike.
You know, one of the things that we didn't mention when we talked with him is we could have asked him about Mount Carmel Cemetery.
Oh, yeah. Well,
there in Hillside, Illinois.
We'll have him back. That's where all the mob guys are buried.
Including Sam Giancana.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. He was an old-timer. All those guys out of the 20s and 30s that came up into the 40s and 50s are buried there practically. All right, if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for rent or purchase on Amazon. And then you're going to want to get the book that Gary just wrote, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
It's a great read, and even better as the audiobook connected with the Kindle that Gary's got. It's got the actual audio wiretaps with transcriptions, because you can't always understand what they're saying, but it is from the mouth of the men that did it. And then if that's not enough, you need to get the app, Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.
Okay.
2, 3, 4.
All right, Mike, we'll come back in just a minute. Here's one thing I want to start. I talk just a little bit about your Facebook page. I want to keep people reminded about that. And I want to let's tell the story about when you put the article up about Dorfman and that Saul Schwartz talking about the new who was going to be the new outfit boss in Chicago. And then I was able to find that audio tape.
Oh, the audio link, that's right.
And put that up and link it to that site so people could read that article about it, and then they could actually hear those same guys that the newspapers were talking about having that discussion. I tell you what, Mike, when I saw that article you put up, I thought, you know, God, that sounds familiar. That saw. And the only thing I really remembered, I knew I had these wiretaps or these transcripts of wiretaps and mics or hidden mics of Dorfman in his office, and I didn't remember any of the details of that. What I remember is that name Saul Schwartz. I thought, well, I've got some him talking to Saul Schwartz. I got this huge pile of them, so I go sit down and I start thumbing through them. About 10 minutes into it, there it is, and I pick it up and it's like, Jesus, this is it. And okay, now go find the audio, because I haven't really paid much attention to that Dorfman audio. It's most of it is just you have to have an interpreter. And it's not very, and even if you got an interpreter, it's not very interesting. So, but I did find it. I couldn't believe it.
And then you recorded it across.
I'm glad you did, because I was shocked when you said you had that audio. I was like, oh my God, I was amazed to actually hear that, because that's the thing is, like, all these people, especially in the group, people get so excited that because they read articles about these people, but they actually hear them talking.
Yeah, I know.
In audio, it's so different. Yeah. We actually hear them speaking, because for years and years you just see their photos, you hear stories about them, you actually hear them talk, and actually hear them talking about the stuff that's being written about. That makes it even more amazing to hear this stuff.
Well, it's all great firsthand accounts, and I think Gary and I have had this conversation before about much of this kind of audio. And you should, If you have that, you should add that to this episode maybe at the end. Is
like, I can't remember how clear it is. I'll have to listen to it.
But that and
if,
that,
if yeah. I'll listen to it. I'll put just a little bit of it in if it's real. It's not very clear. I think it's pretty hard to understand if you don't have the captions, but yeah, I'll put a little bit in.
I think that's the kind of the interesting kind of the dilemma that we have in terms of it's not high quality audio, but it is the actual person.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just
yeah, like, we'll even link the article up with it, because the article kind of gives a little bit of the transcript of it. Not the full transcript, but it talks about kind of the main points that I think they're discussing, who's going to be the new outfit boss after Joey Upa had a heart attack.
Yeah.
So Dorfman was talking about how all those young guys were meeting in his office, and they were discussing who's going to take over and stuff. So it's definitely it's a great wiretap, though. It's amazing to hear, you know, hear him discussing it so was. Openly, especially so openly about that. But like I said, that part of it is rumor, but it is a good aspect thing to think about, though, is at any time, you never know. I mean, what if the call never came in? What if Bush Blassie showed up and the feds were sitting right there? You know, who knows what could have happened? You know, Sam Giancana could have testified. I mean, there's so many what ifs for that murder. What could have happened if it didn't happen? But the puzzling thing to me is, though, I would love to know who made the call to call off the feds and the Oak Park police. Obviously, a major favor was called in there. There was a major payoff somewhere along the line there. That's the part I would really like to know. I bug around. I've tried to do research on it, see if I could find any articles or any information on who made the call, the decision to pull off the surveillance team. And every time, I can never find any information on it.
Wouldn't there be, as a police officer, Gary Jenkins might know, wouldn't there be some sort of a log in terms of they're here, they're there, there's, you know, traffic, and somebody calls and says, you know, we have a dispatch and we need some agents to go to a specific location, or you know what I mean, where there wasn't somebody else out in the Oak Park Police Department available. And so they're like, they call them out specifically to say, you know, whatever car they were to.
Not in this situation.
Yeah,
apparently not in this situation.
Not if it was a fixed deal.
I'm just assuming this, but at the time, too, corruption within the local police departments in the Chicago area were very rampant with mobsters. So I'm sure maybe if there were records, maybe they were destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was assuming that's just a guess. I would like to think that there would be a log. I agree. I mean, you think there would have been like a call log at least at that time reported, like, okay, these agents are at Sam Giancana's house. And then at 10:39, you know, they were called off the house. But I would think, though, there should be a record of some sort, but you never know. I mean, back then, maybe I'm assuming the Oak Park Police Department, you know, I mean, it wasn't rare to have mob relatives as police officers purposely placed in those departments just to get rid of evidence like that. So, I mean, they could have made that disappear really quick, but it's something I never really give up, though, looking at. Every now and then when I have time in my hands, I always kind of search around for articles or any information on that night of Sam Giancana's murder about why they were chose at that time to call off the surveillance.
Well, I was going to, you know, when you think about it, so he's down in his kitchen, and he had a party that night with a whole slew of people there, and yet there he is down late at night, and he's cooking sausages and green peppers like he's expecting somebody to come over and feed him.
Exactly, yeah, that's the other thing, too, is it's like he had that party, so whoever came to kill him had to know that there was a party probably earlier that evening, because he chose that time to come back. I think it was an hour after the last guest left. I think it was about 45 minutes to an hour is when the murder supposedly Bush Blassie allegedly came in and shot him. So that's another reason why I think Blassie was the guy, because Blassie knew probably, well, no one's going to be there. I was there and I was one of the last guys to leave. But I don't think Blassie was counting on Sam Giancana's daughter driving back and picking up her purse.
Maybe.
And so I think that's the part I think where, and that's why I think Blassie was always, that's why he always got subpoenaed, I think, to be questioned for that murder, because of Giancana's daughter telling the police that, you know, she saw, you know, Butch Blassie's car. But I don't think she could identify, she said she knew it was Blassie's car, but she never, I don't think she testified that she saw Blassie in the car. And that's why I think that doubt came in, because I think the police were like, well, if you didn't see him in the car, he could claim that, you know, he let someone else use his car, but it was obviously Butch Blassie in the car, because she said she saw that car hundreds of times, years, you know, because Butch Blassie was always at the house with Sam, so she definitely knew it was his car, but she just assumed that, you know, she said it wasn't rare for guys like Butch Blassie to drop by, you know, like that, unannounced. She said that would happen all the time. You know, they would, you know, guys like Blassie and Chuck English would just come by at 11 o'clock at night. That wasn't a rare thing for that to happen back then. So she didn't give it much thought until the next day when Sam was found murdered. That's when she like, wow, you know, I think, you know, she knows that was probably Butch Blassie too. But like I said, you know, it just kind of fell by the wayside eventually. They just kind of gave up on it.